Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Grant Williams podcast. Joining me again after his appearance last year around this time is Mike Rothman of Cornerstone Analytics. I'll say it again now, as I said it back then, Mike has forgotten more about oil markets than most of us are ever going to know. And for those of you that heard his first appearance, you will no doubt have appreciated how candid he was and remains. And so I'm looking forward very much to having this chance to chat with him again about the current state of the oil market, given everything that's happened between his last appearance in April 2022 and today. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Mike Rothman. Mike, welcome back to the podcast. It has been just over a year since you and I last spoke, which is hard to believe.
Well, that's okay. Time flies when you're having fun.
Ain't that the truth? Ain't that the truth? Now, look, I'm so happy to get this chance to talk to you because I am becoming increasingly bewildered with the difference between price and supply-demand situation in the oil markets particularly. And I remember hearing John Burbank say a number of years ago that price is a liar. And that's something that stuck with me for a long, long time. And it's the more I think about it, the more profound it gets. And so when I look at the oil market and the price, particularly since that 2022 peak and the kind of lower highs and lower lows we've been seeing, it's just kind of drifted from 120-ish to the 70s. And yet, as you pointed out, I think on Twitter a month or so ago, you know, March demand was an all-time high, if I'm not mistaken. So something's going on. So I thought, who better to speak about this than you? So perhaps you could kick us off by giving us just a kind of state of the union in the oil markets to start with. Just tell us what's happening in that supply-demand picture and how you see the energy world.
So in terms of even going from when we spoke a little over a year ago to now, the physical oil balance has actually tightened, except that the price, if you look at the way the oil market is trading, it's trading as if inventories are literally several hundred million barrels higher than they really are. And the gap between what the physical balance looks like and where prices are at really stems from this recurring fear that we're going to have a recession or that significant economic headwinds are going to cause a recession. And you got this disconnect between the physical balance and where the market is actually trading at. And the old rule of thumb is markets trade on the perception of reality, and people like me get paid to figure out what's real. And when the gaps get wide, those typically tend to prove out as the best investment opportunities, right? That the market was always correct, which is, I hear people say, why would they need anybody to talk about what's happening or what's going to happen? And because you realize pretty quickly that that's not the case in most instances. It's really how things will evolve or unfold. You go back a few years ago and you think about what the consensus was expecting. It was expecting a big inventory build in 2021, a big inventory build in 2022, and another big inventory build in 2023. Everybody knew OPEC wouldn't cut. Everybody knew U.S. production was going to just zoom back, that the OPEC plus countries, meaning the non-OPEC participants, weren't going to really reduce their production, et cetera, et cetera. And inventories have been drawn down dramatically, the largest in history, and they're going to draw again this year if our model is in the ballpark, which frankly we think we are. So what's really setting up when you think about where we are today and then where is the market headed is we see this further additional tightening of the physical balance. And I wrote something in the last month or two about how this reminds me a little bit about the sort of 2003-2007 period when we saw what was called a fear-based model evolve in the oil markets, where people kept thinking and believing that we're going to have a glut, that there was going to be this huge supply response, that demand wasn't going to do anything but contract. And of course, they realized at some point how wrong they were and began to hoard inventories as oil prices actually rallied. And The only other time that happened, if anyone's even remembering it, was what happened in the 70s. We had that same kind of fear-based model where people were hoarding because they realized there were structural problems. And the fact is that the way we see the medium-term oil market really hasn't changed. The view that we had and had expressed, got our clients, I think, to buy into correctly, was that if you think about post-COVID and what was going to happen, we were going to see demand rebound and then grow secularly at about half the rate of GDP, but non-OPEC supply would not. We would not get a commensurate rebound in production out of the non-OPEC countries. That was going to put pressure on inventories and OPEC capacity. And last year, we saw OPEC capacity become exhausted. And we saw, again, a draw in inventories on the back of the year before, having the largest draw ever in a year on inventories. And you can see how, you know, this is really still unfolding and points to this kind of multi-year bull cycle in oil, which we think we are in the middle of. So the only thing that looks to be an issue from our point of view is that the price is not accurately reflecting that. And the crunch on supply, to me, is it's there, and it's we're going to get it again as we move into the seasonally stronger part of the year, when demand makes its peak in 4Q.
Let's talk about the OPEC situation, because that's obviously happened since the last time you and I spoke, and that's a big component of the supply-demand situation. Give us an assessment of what actually happened with OPEC, how it was received in terms of that perception, and what the reality of the situation with OPEC Plus now is.
So the OPEC countries have a fairly good handle on the state of the physical balance, and I don't think most people still understand that for the last 7 years, since 2016, their intent is to get what I would call a budget-friendly oil price, which if you look at the Saudi budget, if you look at the comments from the last two Saudi ministers, current minister and preceding minister, they think the 2010 to 2014 price average, which was about 103 for Brent, is a fair price. And that inventories at those levels were targeted. And frankly, that was the goal. And it's not a new thing. You go back 20 some odd years, the idea of managing price by managing inventories and managing your production to do that is the modus operandi. So the notion from their point of view is they're adjusting their production in order to affect inventories, to affect price. And my analysis, which yes, it does make it way into the OPEC jives with their thinking that prices are really lower than they should be. Now, part of what has gone on there, which is maybe a touchy subject for some people, is you've had this massive record release slash transfer slash sale of emergency oil inventories, which started ahead of the U.S. midterm elections. And then you had this bogus assessment put out by the International Energy Agency after Russia invaded Ukraine, saying we were going to lose 3 million barrels a day of Russian production, which would have been an absolute disaster and frankly, physically impossible for the oil market to get around because nobody has spare capacity to offset that. Right. So it was something we called, you know, cow pie on pretty much from the get-go, just because you don't have the ability in the system to make up for such losses. You know, when Iraq invaded Kuwait in August 1990, you lost 4.2 million barrels of supply overnight. The rest of OPEC made that up within 3 weeks. We don't have that kind of flexibility in the system. So the report from the IEA that you're going to have this massive loss of Russian supply was the justification for these record sales of emergency oil stocks, which frankly to me was positioning ahead of midterms here to get gasoline prices down. But if you look at what's happened, you've had like 300 and I think it's 331 million barrels of emergency inventories put into commercial stocks.
Yeah.
Now our clients are very open about saying nobody else except us writes about the fact that you have these artificially inflated commercial oil inventory levels because of these transfers from the emergency stocks. And when people write about oil inventories, they'll say, oh, oil inventories are high, but they're not netting out the effect of this 330 million barrels. So it's something we actually go to some lengths to detail in our research that we publish, because you have too many people that just write about the headline number and don't actually make the adjustment. That's number one. Number two, the latest round of, quote, voluntary production cuts made by some of the OPEC and two of the non-OPEC countries in the deal. If you look at the volume, which I think is kind of a fascinating coincidence, and you think about May through the end of the year, the cut, if there was just 100% implementation of that, is about 285 million barrels, which is almost exactly the amount of SPR inventory that was released since November 21. So I think, frankly, the key OPEC countries want to wrestle back control of the market. They want oil prices at levels that they think are justified and fair. And frankly, budget friendly is the term that I think people just have to live with. $110, $120 oil doesn't really do anything to damage the economy. If you get prices averaging north of 180 for a period of time, okay, we can have a discussion, but we're not talking about that. And so to me, what they're doing and these cuts are really aimed at offsetting the effect of these SPR transfers. Now, the other kind of discussion is you have Russia, which in March, their deputy prime minister said, we're going to have a voluntary cut of 500,000 barrels a day, which was initially said is for a month. Then it was for April through July, and then it became the rest of the year. And people took it as a literal cut was going to happen, as opposed to the fact that they just can't produce at their quota. And they're actually about 700,000 barrels a day below their quota. But we even saw people writing about, well, Russia didn't cut their production the way they said they would. And there was like this misinterpretation of trying to make a virtue out of necessity. I think there's a bigger problem there. I think it's pretty much under discussed. We have certainly talked about it. But I think if we went back to when you and I spoke last year, one of the points we probably covered was the fact that because of the invasion and because of Western oil companies leaving Russia, essentially abandoning their projects, this was going to create a problem down the road because the Russian companies don't have the expertise right that the international majors have. And what you're talking about is a situation a year to 2 years, you were going to see this manifest in their production. And roughly 60% of Russian oil output comes from these old, dilapidated fields in Western Siberia. And at the end of the day, they're in the mature phase of their oil industry. And so this issue of Russia's, quote, voluntary cut, I think really is about the fact that their capacity is being challenged. I think they have issues in terms of their fields and their ability to produce oil. So that's not in the market. If it was, we would be trading north of triple digits, not at a discount to where we should be based on inventory levels. But the OPEC cuts were really more about, I think, wrestling control of the market. And I think physically trying to eliminate the effect of these emergency oil sales.
Considering how crucial oil is and the amount of communication that clearly must go on between producers and consumers, and to your point, the incredibly timely IEA report that came out that helped set the table for those SPR releases, one would imagine that those conversations would take place in the opposite direction, i.e., when we feel like the price is going to go higher, you know, you need to start buying your SPR reserves back again beforehand. And we've seen no moves by the US. There was a visit, obviously, to the Middle East recently, which a lot of people speculated was going to be the point where they say, okay, well, let's start replacing the SPR. What's your take on the replenishing of those supplies?
I don't think this administration has any intention to
really
refill the SPR. The SPR has been viewed, really going back to the Clinton administration, as something of a piggy bank.
Yeah.
And something of what appears to be those administrations, including the current one, as a tool to try to lever down oil prices. It's not a surprise that if you look at the U.S. presidential approval rating and gasoline prices at the pump, they have a very strong inverse correlation. It is the most visible energy price to the average person. Expenditures on gasoline are actually the largest household expenditure yep. for energy. They actually are far in excess of electricity. Most people think it's electricity. So, the U.S. energy policy really and I've been doing this almost 40 years, the policy is always unspoken, but it's the same one, the lowest price possible. That's the U.S. energy policy.
Right.
There's not much in the way of forward thinking, even 9/11. And, you know, I was there that day and all of us were, you know, pretty much affected by it. You would have thought as an event, probably the most significant event really since the Arab oil embargo, that that would have spurred some kind of creation of a comprehensive energy policy. And the only thing that came out of the post 9/11 period was corn-based ethanol. I mean, it was a handout for corn farmers. That was the U.S. energy policy response to 9/11. So this notion that the current administration is going to refill the reserve, that they're somehow pro-energy is a joke. I mean, you had the president in the State of the Union address say, well, we don't need oil after 10 years, which, you know, frankly, bordered on ridiculous. But no, I don't think anybody's under the illusion that they're actually going to refill the reserve. And you have about 26, 28. I'm trying to see my own chart, but there's SPR oil sales for congressional funding slated out through 2031. I mean, right. the SPR is being viewed as this kind of giant piggy bank, and, you know, we'll sell off the oil and fund some kind of a program. But the notion of refilling the reserve and thinking about it strategically is certainly not in the matrix when it comes to this administration.
I mean, it's extraordinary to me. We talk about U.S. energy policy, and you should use inverted commas when we use the word policy, because it just seems so foolhardy as to be barely believable to me that a group of rational people would not sit around and go, okay, we know what our intentions are, we know what we're trying to get to, but there are constraints that surround our preferences, and there are things that we need to do in the meantime to make sure that we can function and not get swung around by the nose. And when you look at the moves being made in the Middle East and China to diversify away from the dollar, this seems even crazier to me that you wouldn't think about refilling the SPR at 70-odd bucks when you look at the supply-demand situation. It just makes no sense at all.
Well, key rule when it comes to you know, politics is to look like you're doing something, not actually doing something.
Right.
That's number one. Number two, you go back to the creation of the Department of Energy from the old Federal Energy Agency, and their mission was to reduce U.S. dependence on foreign oil. So from 50 years ago, that really hasn't worked. The optics of shale crude oil production in the U.S., I can tell you from my own conversations, people are always shocked when you tell them that it's the wrong kind of crude for U.S. refineries. That's where there's 6.5 million barrels of export pipeline capacity that's been built. And there really isn't this idea of a comprehensive energy policy. There's a reaction typically when prices move higher, and it's usually screaming and finger pointing, but not something that's actually proactive in terms of dealing with the energy balance. The issue of Russia and when they invaded Ukraine was maybe one of the most clear-cut examples. You don't even have to have all the background experience to see it, but when you have an agency saying, you know, 3 million barrels of Russian production is going to come because people won't buy it, the first question out of your mouth should be, well, where are they going to get 3 million barrels a day from if they can't do it? And the answer is you can't. Yet you're asserting that it's going to come off. And, you know, the green energy programs and all these other things that you hear, you know, this sort of dogma about moving away, and you ask the question, where are you going to get the electricity from? And by the way, where are you going to get the copper to do all the work on the grid if you're even thinking about this? And of course, there is no answer. It's just, you know, rhetoric being spewed, but people spew it like they actually have factual information to back up the assertion. And look, I'll give you a real simple one. I'm sure in even your casual reading over the last month, you've seen reports about, you know, China's took a turn for the worse after March and yada, yada, yada. People look at some kind of survey data and the markets sell off, oil sells off with the markets, you know, China's weakening, that's going to be the end of demand. And, you know, March demand was close to the all-time record high. But I just ran numbers, which we published to our clients today, about China's demand in April, all-time record high based on product flows and refinery activity. It's a pretty straightforward analysis. the math when we do these things are very highly correlated with what you call the revised and final numbers for China demand. And so you're I'm putting out something saying the complete opposite of what you have a cadre of people asserting, which is, you know, China looks crazy strong, not crazy weak. So, you know, the issue is the lack of attention to data. A lot of people don't crunch the data. A lot of people just take the IEA's monthly report, repackage it, and they publish that. They don't account for different kinds of problems. And then, of course, the big problem, which is no different for oil than anything else, is confirmation bias. People want to be bearish. The anti-carbon rally, the anti-oil pressure, ESG pressures. And so people just want to hear something that oil demand is crap. Prices are going to be weak. There's no reason to think about investing. And all that is going to do ultimately is intensify the bullish cycle. That's what it's going to do, because you have a system that's tight and its propensity is to get tighter, not looser.
How is the, you know, the response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and as you said, all the pronouncements that were made about how the world was now going to work going forward in the energy markets, which just about none have come to fruition. How has that reshaped the kind of playing field of the energy markets in terms of relationships between producers and consumers outside the US, the ways in which these Russian energy supplies are being sold at discount to places like India, are being sold in dirhams instead of dollars? Has the US stepping away from this playing field been the equivalent of shooting themselves in the foot? Are we seeing the beginnings of a completely new dynamic being built in their absence?
I don't know that it's a new dynamic. The analogy that I thought was applicable here, again, these are things we wrote about even a year ago, perhaps you and I even talked about it, was what you're going to do by having the EU embargo Russian oil, and to a small extent, the US. The US bought about 10% of Russian, mostly products, but is you were going to create this giant dislocation. So parcel A, instead of going to party A, is now going to go to party C, right? It's a giant game of sort of shuffleboard. This is what happened, by the way, in the Arab oil embargo. There was no actual physical shortage of oil. It was a dislocation of oil. So dislocations can be disruptive, especially if there's panic about availability that sets in, right? That's, you had prices quadruple and then double, actually quintuple and then double. So with Russia, what they did, because again, the world can't live without that oil. There was nobody that got for Russian oil, despite all the horse shit that was thrown out there that they could, is they moved barrels essentially east. So instead of going to Europe, they were going to Korea, they went to Indonesia, they went to China, they went to India, but they went somewhere other than Europe. And you force other producers who would normally sell there to now shift their sales and move barrels into Europe. And it manifests in tanker rates nearly quadrupling, right? Because you're tying up tonnage.
Yeah.
And it's an inefficient game. And of course, Russia's still in Ukraine. The war is still going on. And the assertions about Russia selling oil at a deep discount, I see the same reports, except I'm thinking, well, what's going on privately? Is there a trade going there to make up the difference?
Make up the difference, yeah.
And the answer is, I don't know. It's not what I do. I don't have my own little special satellite system up in space looking at, you know, what might be moving from port A to port B. But the fact is, this idea of somehow not having Russian oil in the system was, that was a lie. And again, people wanted to believe it. So they got people who should know better to, you know, assert things that were just wrong. The issue of, is it permanent or not, would require me to have a special insight about how the war in Ukraine is going to evolve. And I don't claim that kind of expertise, but eventually, just like water finds its own level, supply ultimately returns to the most efficient way of distributing it. So at some point, I would expect Russian oil to end up back in the European system. One of the effects that I still don't frankly have a great feel about is when you have a refinery or refining system and it processes a typical slate of crudes, when you change that slate of crudes, it does things to the output of products. Now, a lot has been asserted because of diesel crack spreads, basically the per barrel price spread between diesel fuel and crude. So it's like part of a refining margin. They've come off their record highs, but we don't see that as a demand issue. We think that's because refinery run rates are dramatically higher than they were a year ago. But we have to wonder if the fact that they're still high relative to what's normal might be because of this dislocation of Russian crude and what it might be doing to refined output yields. There's not really data for that. All you have are the cash market spreads to kind of look at and assess. And you have a pretty big chunk of the inventory picture if you look at OECD distillate stocks. But the fact is, at some point, I would expect Russian oil to go back into Europe. I would expect barrels that have gone east to that are going to Europe will go back east. But is it going to happen anytime soon? No, because it doesn't look like the war is ending anytime soon.
Yeah, and I'm curious as to whether the new deals that have been struck during this period, whether they stick and whether we see a fundamental reshaping of the oil flows around the world. Let's say that the war ends tomorrow. Zelensky and Putin shake hands on the in Beijing in front of whatever in Tiananmen Square and everything's back to normal. I'm curious as to whether you think that this will ultimately mark a point in time where the structure of the oil markets fundamentally changed going forward.
I wouldn't expect them to.
You wouldn't? Okay.
It's a lot more efficient to take oil that's coming out of the Med and send it to Europe than to and do that in 3 or 4 days and to take oil and ship it around Africa or through Sumed or some other route that takes 12 to 15 days.
Yeah.
Because you eat up a lot of tonnage in terms of shipping capacity. So if the war ends, I would expect we'd get back to traditional flows. The thing that I don't think is going to happen, which again, just like post 9/11, is there was no really well-conceived and then executed energy policy when there was clearly a reason why you should think about an actual energy policy. Saying we should all drive electric cars, you know, is the same thing as saying, well, we should all leave our doors open because if it's not your house, you're not going to go in it. And then believing that people won't actually go into someone else's house, right? So it's the dogma, this sort of normative way of thinking about this is the way it should be. And then the reality of this is the way it really is. But it makes more sense ultimately for Russian oil to, you know, flow back into Europe. That's just more logical. The thing that I think is a bigger problem, and I think it's going to be the subject of a lot of discussions at some point in the not too distant future, is the fact that the global oil balance is structurally tight and not easing. That's what I think is going to ultimately be the big story here. And it's not talked about a lot because the anti-carbon rally, the ESG, the idea that oil is going to go away, we'll be able to get rid of oil, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I think people just want to believe that. And it's a false hope. I plan on doing this till I die. I mean, there's no reason I would ever stop doing this kind of work. But even if I live to be 100, the notion that oil demand goes away in my lifetime, I think, is a non-starter. There's still structurally nothing that can substitute for it of scale.
It's fascinating, actually, you mentioned that, because we touched on this in our first conversation, and you were as forthright then as you are now. And it makes so much sense to me what you said. It's like, this is a pipe dream. I mean, it's great. And we should all strive to make the world cleaner and safer and emissions and all. Of course we should. But mandating that, putting a time frame on it, is ridiculous. It was ridiculous a year ago. And the amazing thing to me is, since that conversation and today, the policies have become more dogmatic, not less. And the constraints being imposed are more severe and not less. And aside from, okay, maybe they really do think this is the way to win office, is to make these kind of promises, I cannot for the life of me see why we haven't reached the point yet where people are starting to backtrack and at least talk in language like, our goal is 2030, not we are mandating that this is going to happen by 2030. It just makes no sense to me whatsoever.
Well, I think Germany had a big dose of reality pie when they said nuclear has got to be part of the equation. So they did a 180 on that. And I think when you and I spoke last year, I said, you know, if you want to go with these green policies, that's fine, as long as you're willing to, you know, live in cold, dark conditions, right? Because you're not going to have heat, you're not going to have light. And, you know, in the summer, you know, you're going to roast if you live in any kind of a what I call typical temperate climate zone. So it's an unrealistic view. Look, I got 6 grandkids. Like, one day I hope somebody figures out fusion in a jar and that my life as an oil analyst can come to an end. But until that happens, people are stuck with me and all my bullshit. I mean, it's just the way it's going to be. And, you know, talking about electric cars is a joke. There's so many people that have so much more knowledge about what's involved in terms of the cars, the materials, and then, you know, the electricity to run it, which I, again, is, I mean, I don't own a copper mine, but I kind of wish I did. But it's the same sort of unrealistic assertions that everyone should have an electric car. And you're like, well, where are you going to get that from? Where are you going to get the stuff for the batteries? What are you going to do with it when the battery dies? And, you know, by the way, it takes 60 barrels of oil to make the plastic in any one of those cars. So you hear all this kind of dogma, but it really is goofy. And the real risk of these dogmatic assertions is what you're doing is you're depriving, in this case, the oil industry of the capital you need to add capacity. This is why we are as bullish about the medium term for the oil market as the last time I spoke. Nothing has unfolded to suggest that the call is wrong on any sort of level. The problem of, you know, oil demand growth remaining in a secular uptrend and non-OPEC supply and even OPEC's capacity struggling to keep up with it is something that has not been embraced by enough people just yet. I think there are a number of smart energy investors. They're positioned for it. They're doing what we would suggest, which is accumulating positions in energy names on these pullbacks. You know, the big move from the call in October 20 was dead right. Not to sound like we're taking a victory lap, we're not, but it's not over. This isn't the end of the cycle. We're still, I don't even know if we're at the halfway mark in terms of the bull cycle. I think it's going to persist for quite some time. But the green energy pushes ultimately are going to make capital that you need to go into oil production capacity that much more difficult. And frankly, that's going to cause the bullish pressures, I think, to be much more intense than not.
Yeah, I mean, that's a constant drumbeat that we've seen. Talk a little bit about client mindsets, investor mindsets over this last year, because as you say, everything I read and everything I see points to exactly the picture you're talking about. And as I said, you're right at the top of this conversation, I'm baffled why the oil price is doing what it's doing. Even with the SPR releases, it still doesn't make sense to me. So has the investor mindset changed over this last year?
Depends who you talk to. You know, there are some very big firms that have kind of swallowed the political correct pill and the virtue signaling pill, and they're out of energy. They don't want to get in it. They've stepped away. And, you know, when you're talking about huge, huge sums of money and not having any exposure or hardly any exposure in energy at all in the last 2 years, you know, you've done your clients a huge disservice. Energy was the only sector that was even up last year. And it was up even with the bumpy start we've had so far this year. It's like ninefold over the S&P since that October 20 period. But there are still groups of people that are kind of on this whole anti-oil kick. And it's ultimately a disservice. But again, we deal with a number of clients, people that had ignored the space and reluctantly came back and said, you know, we think we made a mistake and we thought blah, blah, blah. And our client base has grown. That's not a bad thing. I'm not saying it for any reason other than the fact that we're seeing more interest in the work, but there's still a number of people, a number of money managers that have not bought into the whole idea that energy is in a bullish secular uptrend. They think tech and the high flyers is where you want to be. And, you know, somehow that's going to trump all these other fundamentals that are playing out in oil, and it'll be to their loss. But that's, you know, that's why it's a market.
Yeah, no, look, absolutely right. Is that what we're seeing then? In effect, we're seeing divestments of energy portfolios kind of keep this equilibrium in place, keep the price of crude in check as people kind of divest themselves of energy assets.
Well, you know, the size of the oil's paper market is almost 50 times bigger than the physical market. And anybody who ever took a commodity class in college or grad school or even beyond that, you learn that a paper market matures at 3 to 5 times the size of the physical market, not 50.
Yeah.
So the tail wagging the dog is not a new problem. I was writing about the dollar euro trade in oil 15 years ago as something we had to contend with, and it's spurious. It'll sort of exist for a little while and then it blows apart. But the paper market and gauges of sentiment matter, especially, and this is no different for commodities and equities. Momentum is one of the biggest factors in terms of investment decisions. So You have people that have developed algorithms, AI type models, headline counting models, and they're soulless, and they don't convey a sense of actual understanding of what the markets are doing. It's sort of dumb money, as I call it. But again, we get paid and we help our clients in terms of seeing what the fundamentals are, what they're going to unfold into. And, you know, those gaps between, you know, what we see and what the mass perception is, or those are usually great opportunities. In fact, they're almost always great opportunities because that's the mismatch.
So if we put the war in Ukraine aside, because realistically, the end of that war is the only thing that's going to bring any kind of shock reaction to energy markets. It'll be a positive shock, I feel fairly certain. But if we assume the status quo in Ukraine and Russia for the rest of this year, how do you see the second half of this year playing out? As we move into kind of summer in Europe, energy demand, obviously peak driving season in the US, how do you see this playing out as we go from May through to sort of September, October?
It's going to get tight. You know, the low point of the year in demand is the first quarter. The historical pattern is the low point is in the first quarter. We're flattish or a little higher in 2Q from that rate. Then you're up about 1.5% from the first quarter in 3Q. And 4Q is the peak. And usually 4Q demands about 3.5% higher than your first quarter rate. So think of like a saw blade, you know, yep. The low point to up, then it pulls back in 1Q and the cycle starts again. And, you know, we've had global oil demand exceed the consensus expectation for something like 28 months in a row.
Yeah.
I mean, we all get shit wrong. That goes with the job. But 28 months in a row where you're just on the wrong side of that. Like I said, even the data that's out there, people saying China's weak, things turn for the worst. They had a record rate of oil demand in March, and they had a new record rate of oil demand by our calculations in April. So what we see happening is a seasonal ramp up, and we've toned down our numbers so that it's not like ridiculously bullish, but even using like recession level GDP calculations for our demand, you get a contra-seasonal draw in the third quarter in inventories, and then a larger than normal draw in the fourth quarter, and a draw for the year as a whole. Be the third year in a row inventories draw.
Yeah.
And, you know, the OPEC cuts, we took it easy in terms of calculating the actual cut, because again, I think I have a pretty good sense of what they're trying to do, but the pressure on supply when it's perceived is going to cause that sort of oh shit moment for I think a lot of people. And this idea that the balance is going to loosen up, we're on the other side of that.
Yeah.
We don't see the oil balances loosening up. What triggers the sort of reaction that reality is different than what was projected? That's anybody's guess. I've never been great at catalyst. That's sometimes pretty innocuous.
Yeah.
But I don't see the physical balances actually loosening. And I can tell you, you know, I've been on the way, way other side of consensus calls at different times in my career. You know, year 2000, I was at Merrill Lynch. You know, the view was oil is going to be a $25 commodity, right? And everybody knew it was going to go back to 18. And it was very hard for the roughly 35 equity analysts trying to do their work because no one believed and wanted to believe that oil could be anything over than 20. Just not possible. Demand would die, there'd be this massive supply increase.
Yeah.
OPEC would cheat, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we're seeing that kind of thing now where, you know, people remember, just go back 1.5, 2 years ago. I'm trying to remember where I was when someone said, well, there's no way oil can stay over 60.
Right.
I mean, you know, I'm talking about $8,500 oil. I'm like, Mike, oil won't even be able to stay over 60. You know, like you're combated with that. And it's fine. Like you can disagree and still go have a cigar and a scotch. But people coming at you pretty hard that there's no way oil is going to be able to stay over 60. And again, that's why we have jobs and that's what makes markets. But this idea about how the balance unfolds and what we see, it's going to get tighter. It's not going to get looser. And to me, OPEC, really, you have pretty solid Saudi leadership in OPEC. I've been going to OPEC meetings for 37 years, and they are very well run. And a lot of that goes back to, you know, Saudi and the way they're approaching it. And they want prices at a certain level. They have budget needs, and they have the wherewithal to get it. Most people have been missing that boat for like 7 years. I was in the lobby of the hotel when the 2016 OPEC agreement was put together. Russia was part of that agreement. It was a fairly big deal from OPEC's point of view. And the sea of people were like, this is not going to work. Russia will never cut. OPEC will never cut. U.S. production will more than offset whatever they do. We're going to have an inventory build. And except for what happened in 21, which was the largest draw, I think 2017 at that point in time was the largest draw in inventories in a calendar year. I mean, totally opposite what people knew was going to be the case. So, you know, I'm not in the markets. I mean, if we're doing disclaimers, I don't trade energy. I don't trade the names. We're unbiased estimators. I really don't give a shit if oil goes up or down. I just want to be right in terms of our forecast. So I'll say that to kind of get it out of the way. Yes, I consume oil. I drive a truck and I burn fuel and I use natural gas in my home. But the reality is that the physical balances are tight and they're poised to get tighter. And that's very bullish for oil prices and that's very bullish for oil equities.
Yeah, you bring up the Saudis and how they do a good job of running the OPEC meetings. And you also use the word budget needs rather than budget wants, which is interesting because obviously if these are budget needs, then they don't have a choice. This is something they need to engineer, right? They have to try and get this budget to the point that it needs to be to make things work. Have you noticed a shift in the Saudis' attitude towards their various trading partners? Because you can definitely feel that the lockstep US-Saudi alignment has been fraying a little bit. And there's been a sense, I think, in the past that the Saudis would enact cuts or increases in production to suit the US over themselves if need be. So when I hear you talk about Saudis having budget needs, I'm curious as to whether you think those days are gone and it's going to be, listen, here's what we need to do. Sorry, pal. We're going to cut, we're going to raise, we're going to do what we need to do.
You know, they're not going to build NEOM and the line and support the LIV Golf program by selling, you know, falafel at the Hajj, right? They sell oil. That's the way they're going to pay for, you know, what they need. They have a huge welfare program that's part of the structure of the country. And frankly, the discipline in controlling production is there. It's very well demonstrated. And what we've been talking about for the last 7 years is this issue of intent. Their intent is to control production, to control inventories, to get the prices that they need and want to have for their own budgets. And I haven't really changed anything in that message for 7 years. I haven't felt I had to change it. And, you know, the way OPEC works now is far more efficient and effective than when I started going to OPEC. But you have to understand, it was a lot different. You know, my first meeting in 1986, I was in Geneva for 17 days. We were fighting over like 200,000 barrels a day of quota cuts, which is a rounding error. But back then, they had cut their production from 31 million a day to, when I started going to meetings, to 16. Nobody wanted to make any more production cuts. They were sitting on literally 15 million barrels of spare production capacity, and the whole world's oil demand was like 60 or 61 million a day. No one even worried about the tanker war and what was going on, because they're like, whatever you blow up, there's so much on the side, it doesn't really matter. You know, last year, effectively, spare capacity got down to zero. It was something we had talked about the year before, saying, if you look at the balances and what's going to happen, you're going to be at zero. First time, you know, in a long time, we're thinking about zero spare capacity. And in fact, I think part of the OPEC cuts, and call them OPEC plus cuts that were announced, part of that was just to rest their fields. Oil fields have to be worked on. They have to do downhole work, change out equipment, et cetera, et cetera. It's not like just something you keep producing, and you don't have to worry about it. So I'm not going to get into a geology discussion here, but to run your system that hard leaves certain vulnerabilities. Be like you not sleeping, doing work, staying up. I mean, you're going to have a problem. So the system is tight. And it's one thing if we see it and it's even evident, but when most people don't want to see it or refuse to see it, and then it manifests and they wake up, and, you know, that's where the term crisis comes from. This was laid out pretty well. This has been telegraphed. Look at the oil industry. There's roughly 80 countries that aren't in OPEC, okay? If you take out the U.S. and you look at production since 2010, the 79 countries, you know, not the U.S., production has barely moved. It's flat. Oil prices averaged over $100 in, you know, a number of those years, and you couldn't really grow production. And the U.S. production effectively was the wrong kind of crude, and it's a short life resource, right? So you're like, holy moly, guys, like, do you realize what this means? Do you realize the structural problem you have here? And then what we've been talking about, and I'm sure we talked about it last year, was if you look at CapEx, capital expenditures on oil production or the upstream business, the industry since the 2014 high water mark has forfeited like $3.2 trillion in spending. So you're way behind the ball. And to me, that has yet to be widely understood. We've gone through people making these great big calls, you know, peak oil was a big call. OPEC is dead has been a big call. China demand flattening out, which people made like 8 years ago, that was a big call. Like, people make these big calls, and I said, you watch, it'll be some point where you're going to start hearing peak oil come back, right? When they realize how supply is not going to rebound the way they thought it is. They're going to go from, we're going to have a glut and inventories built, to, oh my God, we have a problem now. And my job is to just kind of lay that out, get our clients prepared for it. But to me, that's coming.
Right. So, Mike, if we put policy aside and come back to the U.S. now, what's the state of oil production in the U.S.? But policy aside, because obviously there's an awful lot of ink spilled again about shale and how the fields are declining, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What's a realistic assessment of the production capacity in the U.S.?
So, to me, 2019, I made this call, which was very controversial, the twilight of shale. And it was the idea that you'll get growth, but the days of big growth, the best days, so to speak, were behind us. I still think we're 100% on track with that. Consensus projections for the last few years all had big numbers for U.S. and non-OPEC supply, and they've been grossly overstating, you know, what happened. The numbers have come in below those projections. You know, shale in the U.S., putting aside the refining issues, the fact that it's great for tea kettle refineries in China and other developing countries. The production growth, the second derivative, so to speak, you can see the slowness, right? That sort of capping. And this is a problem because expectationally, people were believing that there was going to be this enormous rebound in U.S. output. It's not there. That's number one. Number two, you have an administration that's making it harder for the industry to operate. Federal leases and, you know, what was going on with the administration, environmental rules to make it sort of more difficult by controlling the effluents and the pollution related to it, et cetera, et cetera. Those are all like ways of making it more difficult to produce oil. And of course, you have a president saying, well, we won't need oil in 10 years anyway, on top of all of that. So to me, the state of the industry is, and this is a kind of a general point we made, 2003 to 2008, the IEA kept putting out projections for these major increases in non-OPEC supply. And I think like half of the years we declined or had very, very small increases. And that was the mother of the peak oil story. Oh my God, we're running out.
Yeah.
And 2 years ago, they put out a forecast for a big rebound in non-OPEC supply. It was half of that. A year ago, they put out for 2022, biggest rebound in non-OPEC supply in history. It was like 3.1 million. It was like less than half of that, roughly, right? So I'm like, they're setting this up again, where they're saying, oh, we're going to get this big rise in production. You're like, how? Spending's down, activity's down, ESG pressures, anti-carbon rallying. How are you getting this big rebound in supply? And the answer is you're not. And the U.S., because it was the only game in town, so to speak, for a dozen years, the numbers are falling short of expectation.
As you mentioned earlier on, we've seen the Germans do a necessitated U-turn on nuclear. We've seen the Japanese perform a similar about turn, not because they wanted to, because they had to. Do you see a situation where this could happen in the US, where this policy is forced to be reversed? Or do you think there's just too much dogma around that issue in the United States and they will go to the wall rather than do the sensible thing?
I don't have a great answer for that. But by way of example, with a White House that was friendly to the oil industry after 9/11, your energy policy response was corn-based ethanol, number one. Number two, you couldn't get a new nuclear power plant built. You know, the nuclear in the United States went from NIMBY, not in my backyard, to banana, build absolutely nothing anywhere near anything. And you know, nuclear power has its own issues, but you can't get a plant permitted. Just like Bonneville Power was the last dam. You cannot get any kind of new hydroelectric. You know, wind and solar as a solution is sort of a joke. So we typically go from a situation that's bad to worse because there really isn't this kind of comprehensive long-term policy in place about how to think about energy. You know, not everybody's Norway. You know, not everybody has, you know, all these waterfalls and can generate hydro, et cetera, et cetera. But the reality is the long-term solution is either change your standard of living or just much higher prices to ultimately ration use.
Well, look, the hour has flown by. And as I did last time, I thoroughly enjoyed both your perspective and your candor. It's so refreshing to get someone that doesn't shy away from just calling it as they see it. So I thank you for that. Before we go, just remind everybody where they can follow your work, because you've laid out exactly what you do here. But I think it's sensible to let people know how they can actually read it and hopefully subscribe to it, because it's exceptional stuff.
So our website is straightforward, cornerstoneanalytics.com. There's a contact page. You can email info@cornerstoneanalytics.com. One of the salespeople will get back to you. It's a pretty straightforward model. So I appreciate anybody and everybody who does subscribe to the work. And that's it. That's our sales pitch.
But you have a Twitter account. Is it Cornerstone Oil on Twitter?
You know, that's actually maintained by Oliver Parsons, who's he's my managing director of sales. But we do have a Twitter feed. It's more limited than not. But the best way to get a hold of us is really just to email the info@cornerstoneanalytics.com.
Yeah, but the good thing about the Twitter feed is they do post when you make appearances in various places, they do post them there. So it's a good way to actually to keep up with seeing you on BNN, making people's eyes go wide.
No one's coming to me to be Calvin Klein's underwear model unless they're going to do like a big and fat line or something like that. So yeah, it's all about the research.
Well, Mike, you are welcome back on this podcast anytime, my friend. I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation as I did last time. And again, my thanks to you for taking the time to do it.
Oh, thanks for having me on. It was a pleasure. And stay in touch.
Will do. Well, there you have it. I promised you more candor from Mike. And as always, we got it. You know, as I said to Mike, it's always so much fun talking to him about these markets, because he really is very happy talking about them in a very frank way. He's very comfortable in his knowledge of the markets and has a deep, deep set of experiences with which to colour his opinion. So hopefully you found that as engaging and as informative as I did. It certainly left me much to think about, mainly around the fact that the price of oil seems to be way, way, way too low, given what Mike said just there. As he said, you can follow his work at cornerstoneanalytics.com. You can email info@cornerstoneanalytics.com to find out more about the work they do for their clients, which is absolutely invaluable if you are in the energy markets in any way, shape or form. And as Mike said, his colleague Oliver Parsons keeps up their Twitter account. You'll find that at Cornerstone Oil, and they post any of Mike's media appearances on there, which are always worth tuning into. That's it for me for another show. I'll be back again with another edition soon. In the meantime, as always, thank you so much for listening.
Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So, while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.